The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, November 30th, 2016. And remember, if you like this podcast, give us a rating on iTunes.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and we thank you so much for listening today. Donald Trump is responding to widespread concerns about his financial conflicts of interest. He tweets that he's leaving his business in total, saying the presidency is a far more important task. During the campaign, he said he would form a blind trust so that he didn't have any conflicts of interest. Now, there's no indication that a blind trust is what's in the offing here, but it was part of his anti-establishment populist appeal to working-class voters in the Rust Belt states that won him the Electoral College. That populism and nationalism have been scoring successes, not just here, but in places all over the world, Germany, Poland, Greece, but also in the Philippines, Egypt, Turkey, and of course the UK. Elections are also right around the corner in France and Austria, where right-wing populist parties are gunning for more power and polling well. Yasha Monk and Mark Blythe spend a lot of their time studying how and why nationalist populist movements are on the rise and why the United States is flirting with a type of politics that can threaten the very foundations of liberal democracy. Donald Trump's strategies aren't new, but they flourish in a country where belief in democracy itself is waning. Mark Blythe is Eastman Professor of Political Economy at the Watson Institute for International Affairs at Brown University. And Yasha Monk is a lecturer on government at Harvard University and a fellow in the Political Reform Program at New America. Yasha's been researching the norms that make a strong democracy, and he's found that they're weakening in the United States.
We argue that for a country to be consolidated, for us to have confidence that democracy is stable and secure there, three things should be true. An overwhelming majority of citizens should like democracy, give real importance to living in democracy. An overwhelming majority of citizens should reject authoritarian alternatives to democracy, like army rule. And there should be an absence of what we call anti-system parties and movements. Looking at the first one, how important is it to people to live in a democracy? Well, in the United States, people born in the 1930s and 1940s still have real attachment to democracy. Over two-thirds say that it's essential to them to live in a democracy, 10 out of 10. Once you get to younger people, to millennials born since 1980, that value drops very rapidly. You're at less than one-third who think it's really important to live in a democracy.
Mark, do those numbers that Yash is talking about sort of make sense when you look at the other countries around the world, Venezuela, Greece, other places where populist movements, usually on the right but maybe on the left, have gained traction and maybe destabilized a country?
You got to think about this in a longer term. So let's think about what happened to the war from 1945 to 1975. That trauma, which basically instantiated and made democracy a real value for people, led to a policy regime where governments everywhere targeted full employment. That was the one thing we needed. And there was a flaw in doing that, which is basically that once you have full employment for a sustained period of time, labor can move costlessly from job to job. Unions become very, very powerful, and wages have to inexorably increase right across the wage spectrum. The only way that businesses can deal with this is by pushing up prices, and then you get that classic 1970s wage price spiral. So by the time you get to the 1970s, it was a bit of what I call a debtor's paradise. And what I mean by that was you had sustained inflation. So think about all the baby boomers who took out big mortgages. Half of it was eaten away by inflation. And at the same time, corporate profits were low, inequality was low, unions were powerful. Then you had the Reagan and Thatcher revolutions and everything that followed from that. You had globalization of trade, integration of finance. And for the next 30 years, we decided that inflation was the number one problem. And when you target inflation for 30 years, something happens. Central banks around the world since the crisis have dumped 13 trillion euros into the global money supply. And there's no inflation anywhere. Labor cannot push up wages simply because if you try, we'll move your job abroad. And what that's meant is wage stagnation for the majority of the population across the OECD for the past 15 years in the context of a crushing recession whereby the top 20% of asset holders got everything bailed out and it was austerity for the rest, particularly in Europe. That has set a political cauldron up of creditors against debtors, very similar to what we've seen in the 1930s. And that's exactly what generates those types of authoritarian to hell with democracy reactions.
Yasha, the United States isn't Venezuela, right? Venezuela has gone progressively more authoritarian in the last 20 years. It's a mess. There are commonalities in the economy. There are commonalities in the politics that you've pointed out. But doesn't the U.S. have a much lower center of gravity, a much more ballast below it, that it's not necessarily going to teeter the way of Venezuela or Greece because of one election or because of bad wages? I want to believe that.
Look, the United States obviously has a deep democratic tradition. It has a very vibrant civil society. It has a constitution with strong checks and balances. But in the end, it's up to us to defend the Constitution. The Constitution cannot defend itself. And so we'll see over the next years when, as I fully expect it will, the Trump administration starts to undermine democratic norms and practice to try and go against the neutrality of state institutions like the Internal Revenue Service or the Department of Justice. We'll see whether rank-and-file bureaucrats are willing to go along with that. We'll see whether moderate Republicans rebel against it or go right along with it. That's what the safety and stability of our liberal democracy will ultimately depend on.
Well, Yasha, what do we know about all of these sort of metrics of stable governments that you've described? Violating norms is something we're going to be experiencing. You've described it. What's the connection to racism here? What do we know about that?
We know something very simple, which is that these two explanations are not rival. Social psychology shows extremely clearly that when people are doing well economically, when they feel optimistic about the future, they become more racially tolerant. They become more willing to share a little bit of a pie. They are happy when other people are doing well, too. And once they start being worried about the economic future, once they have strong anxiety, they prioritize the in-group over the out-group very strongly. They become very jealous when other people are doing well. So this whole debate we've had over the last 2 or 3 weeks, you know, is it racism or is it economic anxiety, I think is really missing the larger point that these two things are fueling each other. And then I think it's also this very strong rebellion of the regions against the metropolitan center. The economic fate of rural Michigan and New York City has really diverged in an extreme way. And with social media and other things, people who are far away from the metropolitan center have become better able to organize and to have a voice. And we're now seeing their anger playing out in the political sphere in this very extreme way.
I just want to put one thing on top of that, what I think is very important to stress. And there's been an awful lot of strum and drang over this whole thing about whether it's race or whether it's economics. Let's think about what, when you diagnose things as racism, it allows you to do. It allows the center-left, those who have been in power, such as the New Democrats, New Labour, the SPD in Germany in the 1990s and 2000s, who built the current regime, who globalized production, who made people more insecure, whose policies led to a contraction of wages and a huge skewing of the income distribution. They were putatively left parties, but they didn't actually behave that way. They abandoned their core constituents and did a set of policies that benefited the top 20%. This is true everywhere. Now they're getting payback for this. And the narrative that it's all racism is completely exculpatory for these people because it allows the left to say, we didn't do anything wrong. It's not us. We're perfect. It must be those terrible people, those quote-unquote deplorables. And I think that's a deplorable argument.
So, Mark, what's the way back from this then? And I say the way back, not saying that people's choices were wrong, that they shouldn't want populism. But what's the way back to a politics that can reorient the kinds of economics that we're talking about and reorient the politics of the top 20% without violating democratic norms, without calling out judges for being racist because of their birth, without, you know, without attacking the First Amendment? What's the way back from this?
A very large part of it, at least for the left and the center parties, is to re-engage with their own base. The Democrats in this country ran a strategy for around 15 years, which was essentially Wall Street money plus identity politics equals win. That is now a failing strategy and is shown to be so. If you don't go back and actually re-engage with the 20 to 40% of the income distribution that you're meant to be there for, whose interests you're meant to represent, and actually argue for the things that are genuine concerns in their lives, then why do you exist as a party? Now, in terms of what happens on the right, that's an entirely different story. Some people are quite happy with the way things are going. Most of them, I think, will not be once they see the results, and we'll see what happens there. But ultimately, it's about re-engaging, and that's where the populists really do have a story to tell. It's all fine and well to be concerned about global norms and global regimes, the WTO for trade, the IMF for this, independent central banks. But what you're doing is you're externalizing your responsibilities to others who don't have to care. And the electoral price that you pay, you're shielded against because you don't have any skin in the game. So you can do bad policy after bad policy and you keep getting re-elected and promoted to your next position of authority. That's a bad system. The populace are right to call it out, and the democratic forces have to recognise that, re-engage and reinvigorate the democratic institutions. They've got to get people to believe in the project. They can't assume that they do.
Yasha Monk, your final thoughts.
Mark is absolutely right about a lot of these things. I would add that identity is also an important part of this. And what we have to do is to realize the amount of discrimination that does go on, realize how imperfect our societies are in terms of treating ethnic and religious minorities decently, but we also have to avoid a politics that is just organized around identity lines on the left as well as the right. We need to figure out how we can make people see the commonalities, work for a more just society, but not in a way that divides us from each other. I'm very worried that the main dividing line of our politics is now becoming about race and identity. And that is just going to make the fights between different parties more and more vicious. It's just going to make us see political competitors as enemies more and more. And that is a real concern I have for how things are going to play out in the United States over the next 10, 20 years.
Yasha Monk, thank you.
Thank you.
Yasha Monk is a lecturer on government at Harvard University. Mark Blythe, thank you.
Thank you.
Mark Blythe is at Brown University. And as we've just heard from Yasha Monk and Mark Blythe there about the assault on working people by financial institutions and how it's fueled nationalist populist movements, you might not turn around and put your money on a former Goldman Sachs banker to head up the Treasury Department in the Trump administration. But your money would be wrong. Steve Mnuchin spent years on Wall Street before going to another anti-populist institution, that's right, Hollywood, to bankroll movies. He also made a stop at One West. That's a bank that aggressively foreclosed on homes after the 2008 housing collapse. Whether Donald Trump's supporters will like this choice or not, Mnuchin, if confirmed, would be in charge of a powerful regulator both of Wall Street and in geopolitical relationships. For more on Steve Mnuchin, I'm joined by Benjamin Applebaum. He's Washington correspondent for The New York Times. Benjamin, welcome.
Thanks very much.
Steve Mnuchin has no experience in government, 17 years at Goldman Sachs, years more at other banks and a stretch in Hollywood. What do we know about his career and how he might act at Treasury?
He's a guy who has really had a very deep experience of finance and financial markets. As you said, he spent the first part of his career at Goldman Sachs, which is also the investment bank where his father had worked for years and years. He rose up to become a partner, ran an important bond trading desk, and then struck out on his own and headed to the West Coast, where he has become a really important Hollywood financier, backing movies like X-Men and Avatar. So he's a high flyer in the world of finance. What he doesn't have is government experience. So he's coming to this job a little bit blind. That's not totally uncommon for a Treasury secretary, but it is the reality in which he finds himself.
He's got some showbiz experience, as you said, which is something that Donald Trump has proven to appreciate. Do we know how Steve Mnuchin might treat Dodd-Frank, for instance, whether or not Congress moves to unwind those Wall Street regulations? The Treasury Secretary has a great deal of control over the strength and the aggressiveness of banking regulations in the Dodd-Frank law.
So Donald Trump has said clearly that he thinks that that law, the new regulations put into place after the financial crisis, are overly repressive on the financial industry. We've seen financial stocks rally in the wake of his election, as investors essentially bet that he's serious and that he's going to roll back some of that. And Mnuchin has said that he agrees and that he thinks that some parts of those regulations should be removed, that he thinks that they're making lending too difficult and that some of it should go away. At the same time, neither he nor Trump has suggested that all of it should go away. And so the details are going to be really important in terms of charting the impact.
You know, the Treasury Department has a crucial role in international relations. A lot of people don't realize this, but Treasury is responsible for enforcing a lot of U.S. sanctions on Russia and individual Russians, oligarchs who've run afoul of the U.S. government, still many sanctions with Iran. Do we know how Steve Mnuchin would behave there?
So this is a really important and underappreciated part of Treasury's role. The United States has become incredibly effective in recent decades in really hurting the economies of other nations by imposing tight financial sanctions. It's become one of our most important weapons when we're trying to put pressure on foreign countries. In that respect, though, the Treasury Department is more of a technocratic department. They're doing the work, but they're not necessarily determining the course of policy. So Mnuchin would be in charge of carrying out those kinds of sanctions, but it's not clear how important his voice would be in determining which countries should be subject to those kinds of sanctions.
So let's take a step back from the minutia of policy for just one second, Benjamin Applebaum, because we've already been spending time on the show today talking about the rise of populism, the pressure that Wall Street has put on the wages of everyday Americans. And I think we're all familiar with the kind of politics that Donald Trump used to win this election. The question's an obvious one. A Wall Street Goldman Sachs banker placed in the highest position at Treasury, other Goldman Sachs bankers not only throughout the administration, but in the Oval Office itself, in the form of Steve Bannon, top advisor to the president. What does all this say about the populist claims and the people who voted for Donald Trump and what their expectations might be for how he runs the government?
There is some real irony here on the face of it. I mean, Trump in his closing campaign had this 2-minute screed against, in part, global financiers, in which he showed the face of Goldman Sachs' chief executive and basically made him the personification of a global elite that he said had robbed the working class. And now he goes and picks a Goldman Sachs alum to be his Treasury Secretary. I think at first blush, a lot of people are going to shake their heads and say, here we are, back to the same old, doesn't matter who you vote for, someone from Goldman Sachs ends up at Treasury. Now, in fairness, people from Goldman Sachs have charted very different courses in government. Some of them turn out to be populists, people who really press for an agenda that is not at all in the interest of their former employer, and some of them prove to be ardent defenders of Wall Street and the status quo. So time will tell what kind of bureaucrat Steve Mnuchin turns out to be, but it is the visuals are not entirely helpful to Mr. Trump's message that he's an agent of change.
Wall Street, Goldman Sachs, Hollywood, and the big banks. Steve Mnuchin, not necessarily the creature you'd expect a populist like Donald Trump to install at the head of the Treasury Department, but that's where he will be nominated. Benjamin Applebaum, Washington correspondent for The New York Times. Thank you.
My pleasure.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Snowfall has made its way to North Dakota, adding pressure on that ongoing battle over the Dakota Access Pipeline. On Monday, North Dakota Governor Jack Dalrymple ordered an emergency evacuation of protesters working to block the $3.8 billion project. He cited concerns for the safety with the oncoming winter weather there. The announcement comes just days after the Army Corps of Engineers issued a letter to the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe stating that the land they manage north of the Cannonball River is set to be closed on December 5th. Anyone found on that land will be considered trespassing and subject to prosecution, according to the Army Corps. For several months, Native American communities and protesters have been arguing that running the pipeline on their land could threaten the reservation's water supply. Well, turns out that was a similar reason for why the original pipeline routing just north of Bismarck, North Dakota, was rejected. We've reached out to Bismarck City officials to find out how that rerouting decision, at least from their perspective, was made. And we've also reached out to supporters of police in Bismarck who are on the front lines facing protesters. We haven't heard back from any of them, but Karen Von Fossen is the minister of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Bismarck, North Dakota, and she's been providing supplies to the protesters at Standing Rock.
I actually read about the original pathway or an original pathway of the pipeline in our local newspaper. It's our understanding, and I've talked to everybody who I know who would have known about it in advance, that we never even in Bismarck had to make an objection. The pathway was moved away from our drinking supply without our even needing to go to a meeting or write a letter.
So there was never a vote, a referendum, a public debate or discussion about it?
No. To the best of my knowledge, there wasn't. I believe that was a decision that was made so that at one point The pipeline apparently was drawn to be north of Bismarck, upstream of our water supply, the Missouri River, and then apparently was moved. Nobody I know ever knew anything about that routing north of Bismarck.
What about people outside of your congregation, Karen? I know that within the Unitarian Universalists there in Bismarck, they may have been aghast and are going to join the protest. What have you heard from other people in town? Is there a great deal of indifference? Are other folks in Bismarck, white people, aghast at what's happened, or how are they processing it?
There are many people in Bismarck and Mandan of all kinds of backgrounds who are aghast and who are in solidarity with Standing Rock and who have compassion and conviction. Sadly, there are also people who I would just say aren't catching the point, which is that the people at Standing Rock are as important as we are, and that water supply is as important as ours.
The governor of North Dakota has ordered the protesters out of their encampment, restricting access to their campsite so that they can't get supplies, not blocking the roads, but instituting fines once those people moved away as winter approaches. How are you and your congregation responding to that?
If there was ever a time to be in solidarity, it would be in winters like we have here and the winter that is now coming. We have been very fortunate, with the help of many people around the country, to provide a yurt at Ocheri Shakowi Camp, the camp that's in question, and that is an interfaith yurt. There are people who live there. We are committed to the people who live there and to the Standing Rock people, and our solidarity doesn't end when warm weather ends.
Karen Van Fossen, minister of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Bismarck, North Dakota. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Thousands of immigrants, many of them legal, are being held in detention centers across the country, awaiting adjudication for crimes they might be accused of. And that issue goes before the Supreme Court today in the case of Jennings v. Rodriguez. Now, many of those immigrants sit in jail for months or years without a hearing before their deportation is decided. And the ACLU argues that that violates their due process rights. The Obama administration disagrees. They say if lower court rulings in favor of these immigrants aren't overturned, it could risk public safety and the immigration system itself if thousands of people are suddenly let out of jail. Cheryl David is an immigration attorney based here in New York City, and she's here to talk about what this case means for the courts and for millions of undocumented immigrants living here in the U.S.
You usually get picked up if you're an illegal immigrant because you've committed a crime, and that's how you're going to be brought to the attention of the government. Otherwise, you know, walking on the street, an immigration officer or the police aren't going to know whether you're legal or illegal. And right now, they can't stop you on the street and say, show me your papers.
So in this case, Alejandro Rodriguez and lots of people like him, because this is a class action case, picked up in detention, basically in jail, for more than 6 months. Time goes by. And the point is, no opportunity to go before a judge and say, hey, I have a case or I have an argument. You got to let me out.
That's correct. Yeah, I mean, and these are people who have lived here their whole life, like Alejandro. He's been here since he's five. He's in his 30s now. He was a dental assistant. Individuals who have families, married to United States citizens, you know, in other cases, have children, you know, the primary breadwinner, and they're detained for years with an incentive, you know, to stay in the United States. And so they find themselves in a position of, should I just give up and go back to their original home country, or fight for the right to stay and remain in the United States?
And why don't people like this get individualized hearings on flight risk, on danger to others now? Why doesn't that happen?
Because they're in the statute, there are provisions called mandatory detention, without getting into the nuances of the actual law, that basically say if you have certain criminal convictions, and they could be misdemeanors, two petty larcenies, for example, would subject you to what we call mandatory detention. So if you've been convicted of a crime after October 8th, 1998, even if you're not sentenced to jail but given probation, then you're subject to mandatory detention under the statute. how that mandatory detention or the length of how long that person should be detained is what's at issue here. And the Supreme Court, in another case in Denmark versus Kim, basically said that mandatory detention is legal.
So what would happen here if the court ruled in favor of Alejandro Rodriguez and his class, which is thousands of people?
I think that's a really important question and thing to understand for most, you know, people who are worried that you're going to let all these criminals or people who have criminal convictions out. The politics of it or on paper, it doesn't sound, you know, great. But all we're asking for is a hearing. If an immigration judge decides that the person is a danger to the community or the government can prove that they're a danger to the community or a flight risk, then they'll deny them the bond. Or if the judge finds that they should be released, the government has the opportunity to appeal. So it's not as though everybody's going to be released. We're just asking for an opportunity to be heard before a judge about whether, in fact, this person is a flight risk or a danger.
And how many people are we talking about here?
In this class action, it was over 1,000, but, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, you know, each year are detained. So over the course of years or over the course of when the statute was enacted, it has to be millions.
And what does the government say here? Does the government say, oh, no, these people don't have the same due process rights as citizens? Or do they say, not enough judges, not enough courts, we just can't handle the volume?
It's a little bit of both. It says that we can't handle the volume, that it would put an undue burden on the courts if we had to give everybody individualized hearings. But before the law changed in 1998, we always had bond hearings. There was, you know, and the court functioned. They also say that we, the government, has a right to decide who should, you know, who is a danger to the community, and that they make that determination. And also their interpretation of the statute says that that's what Congress intended, that these people should be detained.
Thousands of documented and undocumented immigrants being held essentially in jail across this country. Jennings v. Rodriguez in front of the Supreme Court today will decide how many of them have to have a bond hearing to decide whether they belong in jail. Cheryl David, immigration attorney here in New York. Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
A look now at the relationship with Israel in the age of Donald Trump. Donald Trump has gone even beyond traditional conservative hard lines when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in some of his rhetoric. He says explicitly he'll support the building and expansion of settlements in the West Bank, for instance. Right-wing hardliners in Israel love what they're hearing from the president-elect. But as we've been hearing earlier in the hour, Trump also rose to power on a nationalist populist wave which had clear anti-Semitic messages. It's a feature of nationalist politics familiar around the world that hasn't spared the United States. So what do Israelis make of these two Trumps? The one who says Israeli-Palestinian peace would be the deal of a lifetime, at the same time joining with the opponents of a two-state peace in Israel while at home using anti-Semitism to rally some of his voters. Daniel Levy was a peace negotiator under Israeli Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. He's currently president of the U.S. Middle East Project. And he says Donald Trump is coming to power at a moment when hope for Israeli-Palestinian peace isn't high.
Some people have looked at some of Trump's statements about this would be the greatest deal to make. His early statements about being neutral, his more recent statements in some meetings with U.S. newspaper editorial boards, and said, well, maybe this is a new opportunity. He doesn't play by the regular rule book. I think that would be an exaggerated optimism. Where there could be significance is that this has been seized on. The expectations from a Trump administration have been seized on by the Israeli right inside Netanyahu's own Likud party, inside his coalition, and they've been saying, this is our moment. Let's stop playing the two-state game. Let's abandon it rhetorically, which the GOP platform did at the last convention. Let's go full throttle on settlements and let's annex. Now, Netanyahu doesn't want to do that because he recognizes that this would go, as previous Israeli prime ministers, Barak and Olmert, have said, full-blown apartheid. And then the Jewish democratic state idea, already hanging by a bit of a thread, could collapse over the precipice. So the Trump administration could actually cause a problem, paradoxically, for Netanyahu because it removes the excuse of, I can't do this, the Americans won't let me.
So even if there is a nuanced tilt by the United States in favor of settlements or edging away from two-state rhetoric, and it's not full-blown, as you say, that would also have a direct impact on Palestinian reaction, Palestinian behavior, and Palestinian trust in an American administration that, from their perspective, is trying to pursue an ultimate deal.
Well, absolutely. This impacts two and very possibly three constituencies at least. And the one that you've mentioned here, which is very important, is the Palestinians, because this Palestinian commitment to a state on only 22% of the historic land alongside Israel on the 67 lines and to achieving that through nonviolence and largely through relying on international actors and especially America to deliver Israel, that already looks like a rather unsuccessful strategy. This could push it over the tipping point. And you could see, and at some stage you will see, I imagine, under these circumstances, a much more rigorous Palestinian questioning of whether they can continue down this current road. And that reassertion of Palestinian agency could be an unintended and very powerful consequence of that kind of a Trump policy. The other constituency, is as mentioned, is the Israeli right. They're already self-confident. This could push them over the edge. Another constituency that one should at least acknowledge that something may go on here is the American Jewish community, who by overwhelming majority did not support Trump, are deeply uncomfortable with what he seems to stand for. And this could cause an even greater fissure between American Jewry and Israel if there is a love affair between Trump and the Netanyahu government, the Trump administration. That could have a knock-on effect where American Jews feel even more uncomfortable with Israeli policies. And you could see the two largest Jewish communities in the world both confronting the notion of illiberal democracies. And the dividing line will be, I imagine, between those who say, even if you're uncomfortable with some of this, shut up, Israel is our issue. But there will be a pushback against that.
Did the ruling Israeli right in Israel hear Donald Trump's anti-Semitic speech in Florida? Did they internalize it? Have they talked about it? Or do they simply dismiss it as his domestic politics and the type of division that, in a twisted way, they could benefit from in their own country?
Well, this is a very thorny issue, and there are a couple of things going on here, Todd. But there is a deeper theme here. And the deeper theme is a historically problematic relationship between Israel and right-wing anti-Semitism. And the anti-Semitism that says, you know, your place is not here. Because that has a not insignificant overlap with a particular brand of Zionism, which also says that American Jews' place is not in America. It's in Israel. Netanyahu took a very controversial, I would say, reaction when there were the attacks on a Jewish supermarket in France, on a synagogue in Denmark. His response was not, stay, fight this, we fight this together. His response was, come to Israel. Right. Basically making common cause with classical anti-Semitism, that Jews don't belong in these countries. So I think Israel tends to take a rather opportunistic and indifferent at best, irresponsible at worst, position when it comes to the anti-Semitism of the right. They jump all over anti-Semitism when they consider it comes from the left. If anyone calls for boycotting or sanctioning Israel, that's anti-Semitism. But when the right are trading in classic anti-Semitic tropes and taking very problematic positions, they tend to go very silent.
Former President Jimmy Carter says in a Times op-ed this week that the Obama administration, knowing sort of the state of play that's coming, should recognize Palestine now as a final act and set the table for UN recognition and by implication box Donald Trump and Netanyahu in a little bit. What would that mean?
I think it would be an important marker that they could lay down. It would send important signals, but it would not be game changing because this would not lock in the Trump administration in ways that are likely to fundamentally shift the dynamic. For a fundamental shift to happen, I think you will need to see a real change in Palestinian strategy, a real change in the impunity with which Israeli policies are met. This will need for Palestinians and Israelis to look at it differently.
Daniel Levy, president of the U.S. Middle East Project. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, as you just heard from Daniel Levy there, it's possible, although very unlikely, that President Obama could conclude his 8 years in office by officially recognizing Palestine. But what are some of the other ways he'll exercise his power in the waning days of his presidency? It's something we're going to be looking at over the next couple of weeks. And we begin today with a look at his power to pardon people accused or convicted of a federal crime. Activists who support whistleblowers like former NSA contractor Edward Snowden and former Army intelligence analyst and private Chelsea Manning are making a push to convince the president to grant pardons before he leaves office. President Obama was asked about pardoning Snowden, and he had this to say to Germany's public broadcaster ARD and the weekly news magazine Der Spiegel earlier this month.
I can't pardon somebody who hasn't been, gone before a court and presented themselves. And so that's not something that I would comment on at this point. I've said in the past that I think that Mr. Snowden raised some legitimate concerns.
Well, those aren't encouraging words for champions of a pardon for Edward Snowden. But the president also recognizes the legitimate concerns, as he says, and the policy changes that Snowden's leaks have brought. And it hasn't deterred those who say that Obama can send important messages by pardoning Snowden or granting clemency to Chelsea Manning. Kenneth Roth is executive director of Human Rights Watch, and he's one of them.
Snowden did a tremendous service to us. He revealed a massive invasion of our privacy, one that was not justified by its ostensible fight against terrorism. It was not supervised appropriately by courts. And indeed, there have already been reforms enacted because of Snowden's disclosure. For example, the government's mass collection of our so-called metadata, that is all the information about whom you email, whom you call, it had been just collecting that in its computers. It stopped doing that and now has to ask a judge to ask the phone company or the internet company to reveal much more targeted information. That's the way it should be. There have been other reforms about the court that oversees this surveillance. So now we have the opportunity to present counterarguments. It used to just make decisions on its own after hearing from the government. So as the president indicated, there were some real value in what Snowden did. Under these circumstances, the targeted nature of the disclosure and the service provided, I think Snowden should be pardoned.
The next question you already know is coming, which is that Edward Snowden did break the law, that pardoning him prospectively or branding these disclosures, as much as they did lead to reforms, did put sensitive secrets at risk, and that the message to the next person with access to sensitive information and an axe to grind is pull the trigger.
Well, it's important to note that Snowden didn't just randomly disclose secret information. He was a classic whistleblower. He had evidence of government wrongdoing. There are procedures for whistleblowers to pursue, but he saw what had happened to his predecessors and a number of people who had tried to disclose similar information about this massive invasion of Americans and others' privacy were actually prosecuted. They tried to follow the rules, and it didn't work for them. So Snowden recognized that there were no usual options. His choice was either to stay silent in the face of this massive governmental wrongdoing or to make a revelation in as responsible way as he could. And that's what a whistleblower is. So this is not legitimizing any disclosure of secret information. This is legitimizing somebody who did us a public service.
There's another view of this, which I get that temporarily is not going to happen because the clock is ticking on the final days of the Obama presidency. But I've had this conversation with lots of people, and we've reached consensus that the ideal situation for Snowden is to be convicted of what he did under the Espionage Act, and then to have his sentence commuted, to not be punished as a recognition for the value of his disclosure, but to have the crime and the violation of the law on his record.
Well, what you're talking about is potentially a plea bargain. The other thing that is sometimes mooted is the idea of Obama saying that he would not object to some other country other than Russia granting Snowden asylum.
Germany,
for instance. Right. Yes, and undoubtedly Snowden would rather go to some Western country rather than have spend the rest of his life in Moscow. But the point is that something should be done by President Obama before he leaves office in order to strike the right balance. To charge Snowden with espionage actually precludes him from making a public interest defense. That's one of the terrible things about the espionage charge, is that you're not allowed to argue to the jury, I did this for a good reason. I did this for the public interest. I revealed wrongdoing. That's not allowed. The crime is simply revealing national security information. And so under those circumstances, Snowden can't really risk going to court. He needs some presidential agreement in advance to recognize the public service that he did.
Let's take this opportunity to talk about other potential pardons. Another high-profile case is Chelsea Manning, who is in federal prison in the military brig for disclosing lots and lots of classified information to WikiLeaks, an organization that's not as popular among many Americans as it used to be. Chelsea Manning is having an awful time in prison, has reportedly undergone several suicide attempts and is living in solitary confinement. Is that a case that you think is ripe for some kind of presidential dispensation? I guess pardon's not appropriate because it's military, but some form of clemency.
Well, I think many people feel that clemency of some sort, that is to say a reduced sentence, would be appropriate in Chelsea Manning's case. The document dump there was much less discriminate than Snowden's. There was some wrongdoing revealed, but there was a lot of just governmental correspondence that was revealed, diplomatic cables that didn't have any particular public interest. And I think it's important to recognize that Chelsea Manning also was not allowed to present a public interest defense. She was never allowed to explain why she did what she did, because she was charged with espionage just like Snowden is currently charged with espionage. So given the limited trial that she received, it does seem appropriate for Obama to step in with some kind of clemency, because really the book was thrown at Chelsea Manning. She got an incredibly long prison sentence, something that is really atypical for the way any Western government typically responds to this kind of crime.
With this next presidency beginning and a campaign that saw Donald Trump, let's go down the list, called for bombing the families of terrorists as a way to discourage them, has advocated a return of waterboarding and torture, although maybe he's backed off that now, although it's hard to tell. I know that you're going to have a busy time, but existentially, what are your next 4 years going to be like?
I mean, I'm very concerned about this rise of populism, not just in the United States, but around the world. And we see various leaders like Trump who claim to speak in the name of the majority and who seem to see rights as somehow an obstruction of the majority's will. You know, we're afraid of terrorism, so let's torture people. We're afraid of migration, so let's violate the rights of Syrian refugees. You know, you can go down the line. If we really are going to bomb the families of ISIS, if we're really going to join with Assad as he targets civilians in Aleppo, these are all, you know, disasters from a human rights perspective. And I worry about the long-term health of not only American democracy, but of democracy around the world, when so important a figure as the American president is so cavalier about violating rights.
How much of that fear is tangible for you versus sort of just a disgust with political rhetoric? I mean, as a person who monitors real human rights violations, so far these are rhetorical. The president hasn't taken office yet. So how tangible is this for you?
Well, it has become tangible in other countries that are following a similar path. If you look at, for example, the role of Viktor Orban in Hungary or Jaroslaw Kaczynski in Poland or for that matter, you know, Erdogan in Turkey, these are people in power who are pursuing very similar politics, adopting very similar rhetoric, and are making mincemeat out of democracy. They're undermining the checks and balances on executive authority. They are treating rights as something that are utterly dispensable if their view of the majority will is going to prevail. And so, you know, we've seen where this can go. It's rule of the strongman. And this is not something where, frankly, I want America to go. And it's not someplace where I really want, you know, most of the rest of the world to go either.
Kenneth Roth is Executive Director for Human Rights Watch. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
We've been asking you, how would you like President Obama to use his executive power before he leaves office?
This is Holly Freeman, Portland, Oregon. I would like Obama to close Guantanamo prison.
Oh, he's tried, Holly. He's tried. That one appears to be no longer in the president's power. But 8778-MY-TAKE is our number. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.